We're continuing in Chapter 21, The Order of the Worlds, this evening. That there is a serried grade of worlds within a larger world. That there are planes of being within the larger cosmic being, each plane having its own substantial reality, yet all derived from a single reality. And so, each plane having an independent reality, a projection, as it were, of Satchit Ananda through its organizing consciousness of the supramental, cascading downwards in an involutionary scheme that arrives in matter and then builds back out of it, a number of questions arise from that. Are these worlds interlocking? Do they speak to each other? Do they influence each other? Does all arise merely out of matter? Sri Aurobindo, when we paused last week, was in the middle of a consideration of pantheistic materialism. Does everything actually manifest within a material universe which is identical with the body of God, but there is nothing outside it, in which case any evolution occurs within the material encasement, and there is no concert with other worlds because they cannot really exist. They cannot exist outside the belt of matter. All must be embedded in matter. So Sri Aurobindo is going to continue this argument and then set it to the side, because this is not his position. As you know, he frequently, through the Life Divine, takes up many opposing alternative viewpoints to give them their fair chance at articulation, and then points out how the argument is lacking. And so that is what he is doing here. And he continues on beyond this. So, as we were saying last time, what he's proposing here would be a sort of a flat universe without a successive hierarchy or an interactive hierarchy. It would be a sheer pantheism. Then he says, it has then to be asked, what are mind and life? And it may be answered that they are products of matter or of the energy in matter. Remember, he's presuming the hypothetical that all comes from matter. So then, how do you define and describe mind and life? Or else, they are forms of consciousness that arise as results of an evolution from inconscience to superconscience. Consciousness itself is only a bridge of transition. It is spirit becoming partially aware of itself before plunging into its normal trance of luminous superconscience. Even if there proved to be planes of larger life and mind, they would only be subjective constructions of this intermediary consciousness erected on the way to that spiritual culmination. But the difficulty here is that mind and life are too different from matter to be products of matter. Matter itself is a product of energy, and mind and life must be regarded as superior products of the same energy. So when he says energy here, you can also read subtly the connotation that he's speaking of a shakti which is the expression of chit tapas. So consciousness, which is power, is the energy that manifests itself and encases itself in matter. Energy has become matter, But energy is more than simply that embodying force that gives structure and form to matter. It is consciousness, and it is power. If we admit the existence of a cosmic spirit, the energy must be spiritual. Shakti must be spiritual. Life and mind must be independent products of a spiritual energy and themselves powers of manifestation of the spirit. It then becomes irrational to suppose that spirit and matter alone exist, that they are the two confronting realities, and that matter is the sole possible basis of the manifestation of spirit. The idea of a soul material world becomes immediately untenable. Spirit must be capable of basing its manifestation on the mind principle or on the life principle and not only on the principle of matter. There can then be, and logically there should be, worlds of mind and worlds of life. There may even be worlds founded on a subtler and more plastic, more conscious principle of matter. Hint, the seven earths of the Rig Veda. So essentially, you can't have matter below and spirit above, and there not be any interconnecting planes if we're trying to link from one to the other. There must be the bridge of life. There must be the farther bridge of mind. Steps leading upwards in an evolving stairway that leads back to the point of the cosmic origin. Three questions then arise. Interrelated or interdependent? Whether there is any evidence or any true intimation of the existence of such other worlds, whether, if they exist, they are of the nature we have indicated, arising or descending in the order and within the rationale of a hierarchical series between matter and spirit, if that is their scale of being, are they otherwise quite independent and unconnected, or is there a relation and interaction of the higher worlds on the world of matter? And if not, we're left with a static cosmic order in which there may be other planes, but there is no conversation between or among them. It becomes then difficult to explain how evolution would lead from one to the other. But of that, in due course. It is a fact that mankind, almost from the beginning of its existence, or so far back as history or tradition can go, has believed in the existence of other worlds and in the possibility of communication between their powers and beings and the human race. In the last rationalistic period of human thought from which we are emerging, this belief has been swept aside as an age-long superstition. All evidence or intimations of its truth have been rejected a priori as fundamentally false and undeserving of inquiry because incompatible with the axiomatic truth that only matter in the material world and its experiences are real. All other experience purporting to be real must be either a hallucination or an imposture, or a subjective result of superstitious credulity and imagination, or else, if a fact, then other than what it purported to be and explicable by a physical cause. No evidence could be accepted of such a fact unless it is objective and physical in its character. Even if the fact be very apparently superphysical, it cannot be accepted as such unless it is totally unexplainable by any other imaginable hypothesis or conceivable conjecture. It should be evident that this demand for physically valid proof of a supraphysical fact is irrational and illogical. It is an irrelevant attitude of the physical mind, which assumes that only the objective and physical is fundamentally real, and puts aside all else as merely subjective. A supraphysical fact may impinge on the physical world and produce physical results. It may even produce an effect on our physical senses and become manifest to them, but that cannot be its invariable action and most normal character or process. Ordinarily, it must produce a direct effect or a tangible impression on our mind and our life being, which are the parts of us that are of the same order as itself, and can only indirectly and through them, if at all, influence the physical world and physical life. Remember what he means by superphysical here. It's not simply the spiritual consciousness. It's the real plane of life, prana. It's the real plane of mind, manas. It's those greater spheres of superconscience which lead through the various levels of mind to the supramental, to vijnana itself. So we have the base of matter here. We work and we evolve from that. But above is the superphysical plane of life. As we begin to live here, that life force which is above has manifested in it. So it is naturally in kinship with the life that's working in us. Mind above life, manas, is kin to the mind that's functioning in our living matter. So if those superphysical worlds wanted to speak to us, why would they register first in the physical body? They would register in those elements which are akin to them, that is, in the thinking mind, in the living being, both of which are encased in matter. So it is not absent of matter that they would express themselves, but express them through the willing and conductive agents which naturally respond to them. To return to his argument then, if it objectivizes itself, it must be to a subtler sense in us and only derivatively to the outward physical sense. This derivative objectivization is certainly possible if there is an association of the action of the subtle body and its sense organization with the action of the material body and its physical organs, then the supraphysical can become outwardly sensible to us. This is what happens, for example, with the faculty called second sight. It is the process of all those psychic phenomena which seem to be seen and heard by the outer senses and are not sensed inwardly through representative or interpretative or symbolic images which bear the stamp of an inner experience or have an evident character of formations in a subtle substance. There can then be various kinds of evidence of the existence of other planes of being and communication with them. Objectivization to the outer sense, subtle sense contacts, mind contacts, life contacts, contacts through the subliminal in special states of consciousness exceeding our ordinary range. Our physical mind is not the whole of us, nor, even though it dominates almost the whole of our surface consciousness, the best or greatest part of us. Reality cannot be restricted to a sole field of this narrowness or to the dimensions known within its rigid circle. So these many areas can impinge upon our larger consciousness and register themselves, so vastly escaping the purview and the province of the physical mind. If it be said that subjective experience or subtle sense images can easily be deceptive, since we have no recognized method or standard of verification, and a too great tendency to admit the extraordinary and miraculous or supernatural at its face value, this may be admitted. But error is not the prerogative of the inner subjective or subliminal parts of us. It is also an appanage of the physical mind and its objective methods and standards. And such liability to error cannot be a reason for shutting out a large and important domain of experience. It is a reason, rather, for scrutinizing it and finding out in it its own true standards and its characteristic, appropriate, and valid means of verification. So, yes, we're gullible, and we believe too quickly. And while that means that we can make a mistake, error is also an instrument, as he says here, an appanage, a provision for maintenance again, of the physical mind. We make errors on all sides, regardless of what method of investigation that we use. Anything short of the supramental consciousness is prone to error. Physically married to our experience or spiritually married to our experience. We have to be careful. We have to be sensible. We have to look and look. Our subjective being, he writes, is the basis of our objective experience. And it is not probable that only its physical objectivizations are true and the rest unreliable. This is an argument that stands at the very core of the hard problem of consciousness these days, still being argued in all circles of philosophy and psychology. If you take the material as being the basis for all, how do you explain the inwardness of experience? Has not been achieved. Neither side convinces the other side in this problem. It is a problem of epistemology. It is a problem of language. The subliminal consciousness, he continues, when rightly interrogated, is a witness to truth, and its testimony is confirmed again and again, even in the physical and objective field. And remember, the subliminal consciousness to which he refers here is that inner portion of our being. We have a mind, but it's an outward-seeking mind. We have also an inner mind, which sees more vastly and more deeply and more truly. We have an inner life power, which, similarly to the inner mind power, is more heroic, more noble, vaster in its range of possibility and power. We have a purer physical being, capable of greater sensation than tactile knowledge, but it is subtle, and we are engrossed with the external body. But if we attune ourselves to this subliminal consciousness and govern it correctly, then we can gain access to greater knowledge. This is his point. That testimony cannot then be disregarded when it calls our attention to things within us or to things that belong to planes or worlds of a superphysical experience. At the same time, belief by itself is not evidence of reality. Again, this goes back to our gullibility. If I believe something strong enough, it must be true. No. Sri Aurobindo rejects that out of hand. It must base itself on something more valid before one can accept it. It is evident that the beliefs of the past are not a sufficient basis for knowledge, even though they cannot be entirely neglected. For a belief is a mental construction and may be a wrong building. It may often answer to some inner intimation, and then it has a value. But as often as not, it disfigures the intimation, usually by a translation into terms familiar to our physical and objective experience, such as that which converted the hierarchy of the planes into a physical hierarchy or geographical space extension, turned the rarer heights of subtle substance into material heights, and placed the abodes of the gods on the summits of physical mountains. So in other words, our rather crude beliefs physicalize and demote greater realities to the mere shell of physical being. So the Vedic mysteries spoke of vast worlds superior to the planes available to our tactile senses here. And all the mythologies of East and West have done the same thing and tried to speak about Olympus or Mount Kailash being the apex of the worlds, and there the great gods dwell and everything stems from there. No, no, no. They were speaking of tremendous realms beyond, which are available to our inner experience. You can climb the mountain as highly as you wish. You can attain the summit. You will not find there the encampment of Shiva. Parvati will not be there to greet you. If you want to meet them, you have to go into your inner experience. From there, you will find out what is infinity and what is auspicious. All truth, supraphysical or physical, must be founded not on mental belief alone, but on experience. And and you will remember that the very earliest chapters of the Life Divine focused on experience as being veridical. Once you have tested your experience and can weed out all distortion or gross error and attain to a consciousness that truly perceives true forms and true content, then that is the very foundation of your worldview. You can develop a philosophy based on sheer reason, but it will not take you very far if philosophy is not substantiated with a transcendent truth, which finds the means of philosophy to be the best mental equipment through which it can express itself, but never contain it, because always it exceeds it. Then you have a problem, you see. You must have the experience. And philosophy expresses brightly or dimly the greatness of your experience. So back to his sentence. Let's read it again. All truth, supraphysical or physical, must be founded not on mental belief alone, but on experience. But in each case, experience must be of the kind, physical, subliminal, or spiritual, which is appropriate to the order of the truths into which we are empowered to enter. So three different belts. The physical experience, we can use our senses for that. The subliminal, we need our inner senses to experience the world of mind, the world of life, the world of matter behind the outer crust of the universe, or the spiritual, which is beyond. Let's read that again. But in each case, experience must be of the kind, physical, subliminal, or spiritual, which is appropriate to the order of the truths into which we are empowered to enter. Their validity and significance must be scrutinized, but according to their own law and by a consciousness which can enter into them and not according to the law of another domain or by a consciousness which is capable only of truths of another order. So alone can we be sure of our steps and enlarge firmly our sphere of knowledge. So we cannot judge the superphysical by the physical, nor can we take an element from the superphysical and judge either the physical or the spiritual with it. We must use the appropriate means of knowledge. We've got to get our epistemology right. We have to have the right organ of experience and vision to attain greater knowledge. If we scrutinize the intimations of superphysical world realities which we receive in our inner experience and compare it with the account of such intimations that has continued to come down to us from the beginnings of human knowledge, and if we attempt an interpretation and a summarized order, we shall find that what this inner experience most intimately conveys to us is the existence and action upon us of larger planes of being and consciousness than the purely material plane, with its restricted existence and action, of which we are aware in our narrow terrestrial formula. These domains of larger being are not altogether remote and separate from our own being and consciousness, for though they subsist in themselves and have their own play and process and formulations of existence and experience, yet at the same time they penetrate and envelop the physical plane with their invisible presence and influences, and their powers seem to be here in the material world itself, behind its action and objects. Aha! So we do have this interpenetration of plane upon plane. There are two main orders of experience in our contact with them. One is purely subjective, though in its subjectivity sufficiently vivid and palpable. The other is more objective. In the subjective order, we find that what shapes itself to us as a life intention, life impulse, life formulation here already exists in a larger, more subtle, more plastic range of possibilities. And these pre-existent forces and formations are pressing upon us to realize themselves in the physical world also. But only a part succeeds in getting through. And even that emerges partially in a form and circumstance more proper to the system of terrestrial law and sequence. This precipitation takes place normally. Without our knowledge, we are not aware of the action of these powers, forces, and influences upon us, but take them as formations of our own life and mind, even when our reason or will repudiates them and strives not to be mastered. But when we go inwards, away from the restricted surface consciousness, and develop a subtler sense and deeper awareness, we begin to get an intimation of the origin of these movements and are able to watch their action and process, to accept or reject or modify, to allow them passage and use of our mind and will and our life and members, or refuse it. So these other worlds within planes, because there's a plane of life and worlds within the life belt, there are worlds in the plane of mind as well. In each, wishes to have contact with the embodiment of matter, wants to cast its influence, its light, to form, to shape, to empower, to vivify, to enlighten, to direct, to control, to govern. And they may have some intercourse with us, and we're not aware of it because we're engrossed, to borrow Sri Aurobindo's phrase, in the external world design. And we don't see what's going on behind. We may even deny their existence, and yet they influence and govern us. But as we grow aware, we become cognizant of these forces and powers from above and within, and enter into a kind of dialogue, enter into a kind of collaboration, permit them to enlarge us, to greaten us, or to pour their energies out, or to say, no, not at this moment. In the same way, we become aware of larger domains of mind, a play, experience, formation of a greater plasticity, a teeming profusion of all possible mental formulations, and we feel their contacts with us and their powers and influences acting upon our parts of mind in the same occult manner as those others that act upon our parts of life. This kind of experience is primarily of a purely subjective character. A pressure of ideas, suggestions, emotional formations, impulsions to sensation, action, dynamic experience. However large a part of this pressure may be traced to our own subliminal self or to the siege of universal mind forces or life forces belonging to our own world, there is an element which bears the stamp of another origin, an insistent supra-terrestrial character. But the contacts do not stop there. For there is also, pardon me, but the contacts do not stop here. For there is also an opening of our mind and life parts to a great range of subjective-objective experiences in which these planes present themselves no longer as extensions of subjective being and consciousness, but as worlds. For the experiences there are organized as they are in our own world, but on a different plan, with a different process and law of action, and in a substance which belongs to a supraphysical nature. This organization includes, as on our earth, the existence of beings who have or take forms, manifest themselves, or are naturally manifested in an embodying substance, but a substance other than ours, a subtle substance tangible only to subtle sense, a supraphysical form matter. These worlds and beings may have nothing to do with ourselves and our life. They may exercise no action upon us, but often also they enter into secret communication with earth existence, obey or embody, and are the intermediaries and instruments of the cosmic powers and influences of which we have a subjective experience, or themselves act by their own initiation upon the terrestrial world's life and motives and happenings. So you see how subtle and profound this secret commerce and exchange is. It is possible to receive help or guidance, or harm or misguidance from these beings. It is possible even to become subject to their influence, to be possessed by their invasion or domination, to be instrumentalized by them for their good or evil purpose. At times, the progress of earthly life seems to be a vast field of battle between supraphysical forces of either character, those that strive to uplift, encourage, and illumine, and those that strive to deflect, depress, or prevent, or even shatter our upward evolution or the soul's self-expression in the material universe. And of course, this is embodied in much of the profound spiritual mythology of India. This range of contesting forces, good and evil, bright and dark, that then populates itself on Earth and playing through human figures, exerts influence on human events. And this, of course, we find also figured frequently in Savitri, in other of Sri Aurobindo's fine poetic creations. Some of these beings, powers, or forces are such that we think of them as divine. They are luminous, benignant, or powerfully helpful. There are others that are titanic, gigantic, or demoniac, inordinate influences, instigators or creators often of vast and formidable inner upheavals or of actions that overpass the normal human measure. So, take a glance at world events and you will see frequently some larger influence leaning itself into the Earth's events through a receptive personality with done consequences for us here. We must be vigilant. There may also be an awareness of influences, presences, beings that do not seem to belong to other worlds beyond us, but are here as a hidden element behind the veil in terrestrial nature. As contact with the supraphysical is possible, a contact can also take place, subjective or objective, or at least objectivized, between our own consciousness and the consciousness of other once embodied beings who have passed into a supraphysical status in these other regions of existence. He leaves this undescribed. These may be beings which are like us, coming to Earth, living and passing on, or it may be those who from other planes have come for the human experience but are not evolving creatures and then returned to the plane from which they descended. It is possible also to pass beyond a subjective contact or a subtle sense perception and in certain subliminal states of consciousness to enter actually into other worlds and know something of their secrets. It is the more objective order of otherworldly experience that seized most the imagination of mankind in the past, but it was put by popular belief into a gross objective statement which unduly assimilated these phenomena to those of the physical world with which we are familiar. For it is the normal tendency of our mind to turn everything into forms or symbols proper to its own kind in terms of experience. So we see this arising even in Western literature. Well, in the poetry of Dante, in the writings of Swedenborg. But all of this requires us putting on the habitation for us to gain great familiarity with it, of those worlds that we visit. They must become native and natural to us. We must be able to live in the body of that world and not simply visit it in our internal consciousness, but actually to inhabit, to put on their vestments, to be there as they are. And then we can fully engage, simply as an experiment of projected consciousness. Our real work is here, working out the formula of evolution in the body that we material in the grossest possible way. Yes, this body is our field of focus. This has always been, put into its most generalized terms, the normal range and character of otherworldly belief and experience in all periods of the past of the race. Names and forms differ, but the general features have been strikingly similar in all countries and ages. What exact value are we to put upon these persistent beliefs or upon this mass of supernormal experience? It is not possible for anyone who has had these contacts with any intimacy, and not only by scattered abnormal accidents, to put them aside as mere superstition or hallucination, for they are too insistent, real, effective, organic in their pressure, too constantly confirmed by their action and results to be so flung aside. An appreciation, an interpretation, a mental organization of this side of our capacity of experience is indispensable. We'll put our bookmarks there. But we'll read from Savitri. This, perhaps unfairly, is from Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, The Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. A march of universal powers in time. The harmonic order of self's vastitudes, in cyclic symmetries and metric planes, harbored a cosmic rapture's revelry, an endless figuring of the spirit in things planned by the artist who has dreamed the worlds. Of all the beauty and the marvel here, of all time's intricate variety, eternity was the substance and the source. Not from a plastic mist of matter made, they offered the suggestion of their depths and opened the great series of their powers. Arisen beneath a triple mystic heaven, the seven immortal earths were seen, sublime. Homes of the blessed, released from death and sleep, where grief can never come, nor any pang arriving from self-lost and seeking worlds, alter heaven nature's changeless quietude and mighty posture of eternal calm, its pose of ecstasy immutable. Plains lay that seemed the expanse of God's wide sleep. Thought's wings climbed up towards heaven's vast repose, lost in blue deeps of immortality. A changed earth nature felt the breath of peace. Air seemed an ocean of felicity, or the couch of the unknown spiritual rest, a vast quiescence swallowing up all sound into a voicelessness of utter bliss. Even matter brought a close spiritual touch, all thrilled with the immanence of one divine. The lowest of these earths was still a heaven, translating into the splendor of things divine, the beauty and brightness of terrestrial scenes. Eternal mountains, ridge on gleaming ridge, whose lines were graved as on a sapphire plate, and etched the borders of heaven's lustrous noon, climbed like piled temple stairs, and from their heads of topless meditation heard below the approach of a blue pilgrim multitude, and listened to a great arriving voice of the wide travel hymn of timeless seas. A chanting crowd from mountain bosoms slipped past fragrances, branches with a sigh of flowers, hurrying through sweetnesses with revel leaps. The murmurous rivers of felicity, divinely rippled honey-voiced desires, mingling their sister eddies of delight, then widening to a pace of calm-lipped muse, down many glimmered estuaries of dream, went whispering into lakes of liquid peace. On a brink held of senseless ecstasy, and guarding an eternal poise of thought, sat sculptured souls, dreaming by rivers of sound, in changeless attitudes of marble bliss. I'm tempted to read all the way to the end of the poem. Again, thank you for being with us. Namaste. Namaste. Jai Ma.